Okay, it's Mike Harding. I'm interviewing Alec Bull for second interview on the 8th of June 2012. Okay, afternoon, Alec.
Afternoon, Mike.
So the first question then, Alec, is how did you first get interested in botany? How did you get down that road?
I was interested. I used to collect cigarette cards.
Cigarette cards?
Yes. They had one or two very good series of 50 common plants in some of the cigarette cards back in the 1930s. And then in 1944, I was listening to a talk on the Children's Hour. I was about 17 at the time, by the zoo man David Seth Smith. Encouraging youngsters to join the Juniper Recorders Club of the RSPB, which I wrote away and joined. And then on round about May the 20th, I think it was, of that year, because this was in January, there was suddenly a tremendous flowering of dog roses on all the hedgerows, which of course were very different to the hedgerows nowadays, and attracted my attention. So I started studying the flowers as well as the birds. That was in 1944.
Wow. And did you have any formal training, or were you completely self-taught as a botanist?
Yes. Now, the only... I've got the Service Book of Wildflowers, if you remember. And then when, about a year or two later, I met my wife, and she's also a keen naturalist. And she'd got the illustrations to Bentham and Hooker, but no, not the book of text. So we, for the first year or two after we got married in 1948, we identified plants just from the illustrations, but later we got the text, and that was at Icklingham. We were living at Icklingham for a year or so then, in the Brecks, and well, it just sort of, you know, went from one thing to another. We got reasonably knowledgeable and self-taught.
So it's entirely self-taught with no technical training, and you gradually started to use more technical books to help
with
the identification.
Yes.
And was were interactions, were discussions and meetings and so on with other field naturalists important?
At that time, no, because we didn't know anybody.
No. So you were really on your own?
Yeah. We were. Or I was, anyway. Except the only contact I had, I think, with a botanist at that time, when we were living at Icklingham, this 1948, early 1949, I met a disreputable old gentleman on Ramparts Field, I think it was, or Westo Heath, anyhow. The shabby old raincoat, peaked cap pulled in over his eyes. And they went to stone curlers nesting nearby, which they, and I'd had a, because we had a friend, Tony Vine. I don't know if you've heard of Tony.
I have heard of him,
yeah. Yeah, well, he at that time was in the RAF, stationed at Milton Hall. He came from Shipley Hill, actually. And he used to drop in. We met him. We lived at a cottage up. I don't know how well you know that area.
Vaguely, I know Shippy Hill. And,
yeah, no, Icklingham, I mean.
Oh, a little bit, yes, yeah.
I don't know if you know where the Icklingham Way goes off from West Oheath right through to Elverton.
Yes, I do, yeah.
We lived in that little cottage about a quarter of a mile up there.
Oh, fantastic place to live.
Night jars outside the bedroom window keeping us awake. And
God, what a pleasure to be kept awake.
Stone curler in the garden once.
Wow.
Three pairs of redback strike on within a quarter of a mile. And anyhow, Tony used to go backwards and forwards along with, sometimes with a friend, David Butt, who was at Colford at that time. And he had wanted to keep her eyes open for egg collectors. So I met this disreputable old gentleman. So he comes up to me, he says, "Anything about?" I said, "Not a lot, I don't think," very cautiously. "Oh, I'm a bloody naturalist, see? I just broke out from Berry to see the red flowers. Before they all go over." And it turned out he was a chap called Henry Borum.
I don't know that name.
No. He worked in the sewage department at the Berry Corporation. And he was a very good naturalist. He was made an honorary member of the Suffolk Naturalist Society, actually, for his work with digger wasps.
Oh, okay, okay.
And, he was a character, one of the old characters.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was the only botanist, you might say. I don't know how good a botanist he was, good enough, I suppose, that I had contact with.
So in more recent years, you've been very well in with the Norfolk botanists, writing the film and so on. When
yes.
did that kind of little community start to get together?
By accident, really.
As all the best things do.
Yeah. No, let's see. When we came to Norfolk in 1960, there was, I don't know when it started, but there was a Flora Breckland. It ended up with Trist's publication, the Ecological Flora Breckland. And the organiser of the actual recording was, because I joined the Norfolk Nats when we moved to Norfolk, around 1960 or just after, was Dr. Jeff Watts from Keswick. He's organised it, and he... I don't know which came first, the Breck Flora or the other one. Anyhow, I joined with him. First of all, they did a survey of the Yare Valley in the sections right the way down from the start down to Norwich, I think. And then I was one of, there was Jeff, Ernest Daniels from Norwich, and myself. Did a survey of the Wensum from Ringdon Bridge down to Helston. And whether that came before, I can't remember whether that came before the Breck Flora. I have no idea, it came after the Breck Flora, actually. Anyhow, I was recruited to do various. It was one square in four, if you've ever seen Trist's Ecological
Flora. Yes, I have, yes.
Yeah. It was one square in each tetrad. And I did quite a number of those. Or we did together. Including the best tetrad that was recorded, which was Thompson Common.
Oh, yes.
That was one of mine. I think I got about 320 species in our tent case. In one case square.
Wonderful sight.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then I did this study of the Wensum. And then... Oh, I had 14 years. I volunteered in 1968 to be BTO regional representative for West Norfolk. That was at the time when they were starting their first bird atlas.
So BTO, British Trust for Ornithology.
Yeah, yeah.
You were a broadly interested naturalist, not just...
Oh, yes, I've taken everything.
Yeah.
But, no, I was a member of the BTO and... Well, when we moved to Norfolk primarily in 1960, the BTO started their common bird census. And I took on one of their biggest plots, actually. It was 250 acres of a 800-acre farm at the Cranworth. And even though we left 7 years, about 5 years later, I managed to keep on doing that plot, and I did it for 29 years. Till 1991. But as I was into the BTO at that time, in 1968, I think it was, I became regional rep for West Norfolk and organised the first bird atlas for the west of the county. I had 14 years doing that. And then when I was 46, 78, 82, that was getting a bit, that was getting a bit too technical. So I gave up the that. And then in 84, I took on Eastnoff for the BSBI, the Botanical Society. And I had 14 years as county recorder for the BSBI in East Norfolk. In 1987, that was when the monitoring scheme was carried out. Because I was working, well, I was working about 60, 65 hours a week with the cows over here. And because we came into, well, we moved to the cottage on the farm in 73 and then managed to buy this place in 75. So, which year had I got to?
you'd got, I think you were in the...
Oh, yes, in the, yes, it was 1987, after the monitoring scheme. Gillian Beckett, do you know Gillian?
I don't know her, but I know of her.
Yeah. Carried straight on from there, starting to record the flora of West Norfolk. And, I think it's Peter Lamley, sort of making noise and saying, you ought to be doing the flora of East Norfolk as well. Well, I was pretty tied up with work and so on. I was rather reluctant, but I eventually agreed. And I started recording the flora of East Norfolk in 1990. Then in, I was due to retire in August 92, but I had a bad bout of Aspergillus fumigatus on my lungs. It had been building, I suppose, and we used to feed wet sugar beet pulp.
Right.
And the, instead of having clean plastic covering it, it was always the plastic that had been used for the silage. And that used to go mouldy on the sugar beet. And one morning in March 92, I took the sheet off and it knocked me practically flat on my back. I just couldn't get my breath. So I had to pack up quick and go and see the doctor. And he gave me inhalers and so on and said, well, you go back to work and see how you get on, but avoid the, you know, the sugar beet pulp. But when I got back, I went back to work after about a fortnight, and just the air in the from the a concentrate coming down the spouts when you, you know, it's all done automatically. The dust from that was too much, and I had to give up altogether. Mm-hmm. So I retired 5 months early, and then I was, of course, there was the flora to be done.
Flora of Norfolk.
The flora of East Norfolk, 714 tetrads. And so I set off about three times a week, start recording, and I think by the end of the period, and we finished in 1998, I think I'd visited more than 600 of the tetrads myself. And South Norfolk, there were no recorders in South Norfolk whatsoever. So I did the whole of, or most of, I had some help from Mike Hall at Skull for that area, and he got me, he knew a lot of people because he had been an agricultural rep, and he knew a lot of the people along the valley, so he got me into a lot of the marshes along from there right down to Beckles. Hmm. Otherwise I shouldn't have been able to have done them. But anyhow, I think I did the whole of 2-8 as far as it lies in Norfolk myself, most of 2-9. That's 10 K squares.
Yeah.
1-8, 1-9. Mike did something as well, but very often it was with me because he's not the most proficient of botanists. And quite a bit of the 3-8s, and, oh, not 3-8s because that didn't come in, 3-9, 3-0, and so on. And anyhow, that took us up to 1998. And also in 1968, Swan published his Flora of Norfolk. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah, Petch and Swan. Yeah.
Yes. And I did have contact with him since we came to Norfolk because I found one or two things at Cranworth that he didn't believe, so he had to come and see them.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was accepted into the Norfolk fold by him. And when his Flora was published, I discovered that all the Bramble records, or most of the Bramble records, were those of the Reverend E.F. Linton at Sproston in 1890. I thought, well, if nobody else has done them, I'll do them, because nobody can argue with me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyhow, a chap called Eric Ease from Newcastle in Staffs was the then referee for Barubas, and I made a collection of what I thought were, you know, reasonable things. We were living in Foxley at the time, and sent them to him. And he said, well, you've got one or two interesting things, but you got mostly wrong. So I said, well, can I send you some more next year? Well, he said, my wife's people live at Necton, and we should be coming down in October, and you can collect what you, you know, find this year. This year, I'll come and look at them in the and you won't have to send them. And if you could take me into a wood which has got a good variety of brambles in, he said, I'll point some out to you and you can collect them next year. So we did that. He came over in October, found one or two very nice things that I got, including one which was then a new county record, although I've since found it's quite widespread. It's a northern thing called Rubus macronulatus. And we went around Foxley Wood in October, and he was able to name 14 species off the top of his head. Wow. Which I went round to collect the following year, and that was formed the basis of my collection, which now my herbarium now runs to about 230 species, about 3,000 sheets.
Wow.
I've got a vast cupboard full of them.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
And yeah, I've taught myself brambles, and since, oh, it must be 10 years now, I've been BSBI referee for brambles from the Humber down to the Thames.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, that's a fabulous story.
So, yes, you can teach yourself.
Yeah, yeah, obviously, obviously. That's a wonderful story. And thinking about now the Little Ouse Valley.
Yes.
Can you just confirm how long it was that you lived in the area and when?
Well, we lived at Garbleston from roughly October 51, October 52.
Okay. And which are the sites in that area, Alec, are you most familiar with?
Red Ground Lob and Fen. Yep. We had visited before we went there, and we've visited pretty often since. But and apart from that, the other site that we visited quite a lot until it got blown up, of course, was Garbleton Heath.
Right, I've seen your notes on that. Can you describe what it looked like? What kind of a heath was it?
It was a mixture of grass, chalk grassland, and heather. Sort of in the, I suppose, in the stripe, like Grimes Graves.
So a classic Breckland Heath.
Yes.
And it had an acid flora and a chalk flora.
Yes.
All separated in the usual patterned ground.
Yes,
kind of way.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yes, and of course we didn't have time to explore it, because we got two small children at that time. And so we didn't get up to the top part of the heath, which where the spoke speedwell used to be.
Right, right.
If you've read Clark's In Breckland Wilds, Galsham Heath was used to be blue with spoke speedwell.
Wow.
And there was some remaining on the Devil's Dyke after it was ploughed, and some was taken from there. I don't know who did it. Well, English Nature, I think, supervised it. It was taken from there into the forest opposite. That's the road from...
Look, we're looking at the map now. When you say the forest opposite, do you mean this area, Alec? Or no, this area?
That area.
So Alec's pointing.
See, Devil's Dyke right up there.
Yeah.
How far Galsham Heath extended, it says there. But I think it... From memory, it probably extended almost to the Harling Five Ways,
right,
which is up there.
Right.
Anyhow,
so the forest you were referring to, Alec, is the huge block of forest to the northwest of the heath.
That's right. Yes.
Okay. Okay. And when it was ploughed up, how was that done? Was it bulldozed?
It was bulldozed.
It was bulldozed.
It was bulldozed.
So, what were they doing? Were they trying to take the topsoil off, or?
No, they're just levelling the irregularities, pushing all the bushes and heather and so on one side. And it was all done within they were doing it by degrees. They started at the top end. I got down to the road about mid-June, and it was planted almost straight away.
And what do you think the chances of that patterned ground surviving a process like that? Would it have obliterated the patterned ground?
I would have thought so. Because it's been cultivated for so long now that any chalk that was near the surface would have been ploughed out.
And have you had a look at it since it's been cultivated?
We've been past it quite a number of times. It usually looks like a rich corn
yes.
field.
Yeah, it's probably been fertilised.
Oh, yes, definitely.
What about the margins? I wonder what might be surviving around the margins.
Played right to the edge of the road.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the other side is also, I think the other side has been put down to grass.
Right.
No, the last side, that's where are we?
So
this bit.
The map again. So we're talking about south of the A Road.
Yes.
South of the A Road.
Yes, south of the A Road. Where those footpaths are.
Yeah.
That was heath down to there, which was that was mostly chalk heath. There was some heather along near the road, but there was also a marl pit somewhere in the middle,
yeah,
which had quite a good chalk. Well, had excellent chalk floor, and also a face where the sand martins used to nest.
I wonder that may have been filled in, I guess, as part of the improvement.
Well, Helen Smith said that. It's still more or less quite a big pit, and the current farmer is filling it with rubbish.
Oh, what a shame! What a shame! And what about the fen on the south end? It's marked on the map as woodland now. Was that all fen when you visited it?
Well, it was fairly fenny. It was growing up with a certain amount of bushes, I suppose, but it had got things like arsenic foil and tormentals and so on. I don't say we penetrated it very far, but...
Okay, was it boggy? Did you get the sense of there being springs and groundwater in the bottom of it?
There was some springs, I suppose, as there is in quite a lot of places like that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't recall that it was very wet.
Right, okay, okay. And what about the river valley where now there's Scarf Meadows and so on? Do you have any memories of the floodplain?
No, because that was... I don't remember even if I walked along the footpath. Because when we went anywhere, we usually went on the bikes.
Okay.
But no, I didn't know that area very well at all. It was just that we came down to that bit, you know, that was the last bit that was cultivated.
What about Garbalsham Old Fen, which is still existing but quite treed up? Do you have any memories of that area in the 50s?
Not really. I think I did go into it once or twice, and I think we got, again, arsenic foil in there, but I don't remember anything particular about it.
I think in the northern area, I've seen records for groundwater-fed fen plants like Sheenus and so on. You've got no memory of seeing those up there?
No.
No, okay. Okay. And of course, it's connected with Brumscott yes. Common now. We've got lots of records from you on Brumscott Common.
Yes.
Can you remember what Brumscott Common looked like?
Not that much different to what it does now, except that it was a bit bleak when I was there last year because it was so dry. But there used to be woodlarks on there.
Mm.
And tree pipits as well, I think.
Was it essentially a grass heath or was there heather?
I don't recall there being heather on there.
No. I don't think there's much, if any, now.
I don't think there is.
There's quite some patches of lichen heath.
Yes, there is, yes.
Has that always been there?
I think so, yes.
Okay. Okay. What about the gorse? Was that there in the early 50s?
There would have been gorse, but it wouldn't have been as overpowering as it has been in recent years because that spreads by neglect because it seeds so freely.
Mm. And do you remember much about the meadow and the fen? As you go down the slope, it goes into meadow and then into fen. Have you got many memories of what that looked like?
Not particularly, no.
No, okay. So maybe not a particularly notable piece of habitat.
No.
No, okay. There's only a little bit of Brumscott Common left now, this area here.
Yes.
But it was obviously, there was more of that habitat around. Do you remember what the surrounds looked like?
No, I don't, quite honestly. Nice. I didn't realise that there was any the other side of the Smallworth Road.
I think there might be. There's certainly area. There's little fields along the Smallworth Road with lots of ragwort and heathy kind
of... Oh, yeah, plants. I soon remember that from memory, the Frithels always had a lot of ragwort on it.
I think so, yes, at the other end of the valley. That's right.
We didn't go on to the Frith because we thought it was private because it always had sheep and things on it. Or I'm not sure somebody didn't have some pigs on it on one occasion.
That might be the case. So you were there in 51 and 52. Can you remember what the Frith looked like even from the road? Was it heathy?
Yes. It was very much humps and holes. It wasn't level like it is now. And there may have been a little heather there from memory. But as I said, we didn't go on to it because there was always, during the summer, cattle or sheep or something on there. And so we, you know, didn't trespass.
No, no. Okay, but
We used to go down to South Lock and Fen, which was very different to what it is now. Where is it?
South Lock and Fen, Redgrave Fen, south of the river, is on that side. That's Bellamy.
Yeah, well, the entrance to South Lock and Fen then was there.
Yes, I think that is still a way to get on, yeah.
And that bit was not trees, it was open heath.
So Alex pointing at the bit alongside the road, north of the river, on Little Fen.
Yes.
Where there are now some birch trees, but Alex saying they
and, well, it's aspen, isn't there?
Yeah, there's all sorts of things.
Well, I think the aspen sackered along and smothered, because that was pure heath.
Right.
Alongside the road. And I remember seeing a very large adder on there on one occasion.
There are still adders on the fen.
Yes.
Yeah.
And milkwort heather.
Yeah.
And some very good moths. Don't know what year that was. That was still there when I took a chap called... Oh, dear. He was a friend of Ede's. It must have been in the early 70s. He was a friend of Ede's from Newcastle, Staffordshire, who was an entomologist. And I took him there, and he found one or two rare moths, which I suppose are still there somewhere. But
okay. And do you have any memory of these sites along the south side of Fen Road in Blow Norton? So Blow Norton Fen itself... or the lows down here?
I don't remember that part, but I do remember on a number of occasions commenting that Blow Norton Fen looked as if it ought to be, you know, worthwhile visiting. But I don't seem to have got any notes that I did actually visit it.
Oh, that's interesting, because there are records for liparis, probably in the early 50s, and the whole place was thought to be sort of very... quaking before they really dredged the river.
Yeah.
You never got into that site?
No, I'm afraid I didn't.
No, okay.
I did once have a look, but I think that was later, at Thelnethan Fen, hoping to find leprous, but I didn't.
No, that's a shame.
Yeah.
Any other sites in the valley you can remember seeing, even if it's just how you remember them looking visually?
Not really. That's 60 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. You're remembering an amazing amount. How about around Garbaldisham Village? You know, there's a little cluster of sites around there. I wonder if there's any sites that we don't know about that you can remember.
Not beyond what I've already said about the heath, I don't think.
So Brumscott Common, Garbaldisham.
Garbaldisham Heath.
Was it also known as Garbaldisham Ling? Is that the same site, or is it?
No, the Ling is up here.
Ah, I wondered about that. So now Alex.
Where are we? Ling Farm.
Okay, so Alex pointing at the area of the map with Ling Farm.
Yes, that was where I referred to the Ling.
And what kind of landscape was that when you were there?
Mostly reseeded grassland.
Okay,
because
so
there was arable round it, but the area around the Ling, well, that side of it anyhow, was, and there was some grassland there as well. They've got a herd of about 110 cows, which was a lot for that time of day, and they mostly fed off the. Yeah, that was all grassland, surrounded by arable the straw and so on, used for the cattle, and the sugar beet tops, and used to grow kale and so on.
Right, okay. And what about this area? This part of the map here, now I'm referring to an area just south and east of the Ling, which is very empty of roads, it looks very open. What kind of landscape would that have been?
I suppose that was arable.
That was all arable.
I think so, probably, yeah.
And this area now, I'm going back towards Garbaldisham Heath, the block of woodland in the middle, that's now Forestry Commission. What kind of woodland would that have been? Was that always plantation?
Yes, it was always plantation.
It was always plantation.
Yeah. It was. I went through it once or twice, and found it was not particularly interesting.
Right. Okay.
There were some good lanes somewhere between North Lopmond, the Ling, because Swan had the only record of Thorwart.
Oh yes.
Somewhere out in that bit, I searched those lanes and. Well, for our flora, we couldn't find anything like that.
What were the hedges and the tree cover like around the village in your time?
That side of the road was much the same as it is now. So
to the west of the
main road. And there were some mature trees there. The hedges on the Ling were kept trimmed, I don't know, about a 2-year rotation, I think.
So very short.
Yeah, very because they were good hedges, you know, from the point of view of birds nesting like that and about like that.
So
but and they were usually cut, so I don't know what time of the year it was done, sort of alternate years. Piece work by the men on the farm by hand.
Okay, yeah.
In other words, you know, no machinery.
So billhook, saw.
Yeah. Yes, because most of the work on the farm, for the general work, was piece work.
Yeah.
Which was unusual.
For the day, most people were directly employed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but there's, I mean, it's 500-acre farm.
And it was a big farm for the 50s, I would think.
It was. Yeah. And there were 33 men working there.
Right.
And 10 working horses.
Yeah.
As well as 2 antiquated forts and tractors.
Yes. Were there any meadows, wildflower meadows, in the area that you can remember?
The meadows were all, you know, reseeded.
Even by the 50s,
yes.
Early 50s, they were all reseeded.
Yeah.
So the farmer must have been what in those days would have been thought as very progressive.
Yes, well, I think
very
he was.
Modern.
John Laurie came down during the 30s, and it was said, I don't believe it, I don't think, it's because I mentioned that I wrote a book on the subject, on my experiences, which got into the hands of his widow, and she disputed that I said in the book that when John came down from Scotland, and he, you know, worked really hard, that if he got wet through, he had to go in and dry his clothes before he could carry on because he had only brought one suit with him. That was disputed. But, yeah, he was a very hard-working chap, a wonderful chap, actually, very good boss. And, of course, unfortunately, he died of a heart attack when he was 49.
Right. Maybe, yeah, that's very early.
Yeah.
So have you any other memories, Alec, other than in the notes you've given us, of the wildlife of the area that you think would be useful for us to know about? Or are you comfortable you've covered it all?
I think so. The bird life was a lot better than it's likely to be now. I don't know whether you still get them, but kingfishers were commonplace along the Little Ouse.
They're still there, but I wouldn't say they were commonplace.
No, we used to see them cycling over the bridge into Hopton, wherever that is over here.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, we used to see them there regularly. Woodlark, as I mentioned, tree pipit. And, of course, before they played the heath up there, were nesting yellow wagtails, several pairs and so on. Stone curlew were up there too.
Right, on the old Garbaldsham Heath.
Yeah. And during that autumn, they packed up, and I could hear them up on the ling, somewhere not very far away, every morning at daybreak.
Right, wow.
I bet you wouldn't get any up there now.
I don't imagine you would. Okay, well, thanks very much for that, Alec. Thanks for all those extra memories. And thanks again for taking part in the project.
That's okay.
And we'll finish the interview now.
Right.